Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN with Dr. Valerie Fadock, who is a legend in veterinary dermatology. And I will tell you, I believe one of the issues, maybe the most often seen issue, Dr. Fadock, in veterinary medicine is a skin issue of one kind or another. Am I right about that?
Yes. Hello, Steve, and thanks for having me on the show. I am very passionate about skin diseases in really any animal, but dogs and cats in particular, because they really struggle with this. And so a lot of the surveys that have been done by insurance companies show that itching, allergic skin disease and ear infections are the most common in dogs, and they're right up there in cats too.
Is this more common, do you think? Because you've been doing what you do for a couple of years, is it more?
Oh yeah.
Is it more common today than say 15 years ago? And if so, why would that be?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and it's something we talk about all the time. I think one thing that impacts is we are better at recognizing these conditions, and people's relationships with their pets have changed. So, you know, we watch them in our houses more than we did when I was younger, and so we're there to observe. But I do think that allergies are getting worse, and it's partly because of the same reasons allergies are worse in people. We have a variety of environmental things that contribute to allergy, not just pollens and mites, but changes in climate, which allow these allergens to last longer throughout the year. We know that air pollution can affect the skin just like it does the lungs. So it's a combination of both. We recognize it, and we are seeing more.
All right, so it is assumed, let me give this example. It just happened today. I'm talking to a cat owner who said, oh, my cat had a bloody stool and has had it for a week or so. Went to the veterinarian, assuming that it's an allergy. The veterinarian, I'm not knocking into any individual veterinarian here, assumed somehow it was an allergy. Of course, I don't know the entire story, but now she's on a novel diet. Instantly on this novel, expensive prescription diet. I don't know what it, like moose and something. It wasn't literally moose, but it's some novel. It might be venison. It's something like that.
Right.
You know, it's one of those diets that I don't know the specifics of this general case. But too often, are we jumping to the point where the problem is a food allergy when it probably isn't?
I totally agree with that. Now, you know, usually if it's an acute onset GI disease, whether it's vomiting or diarrhea, we would look for, parasites. We would look for some kind of irritants in the gut, maybe an infection. I don't usually jump to food allergy right away because all of the published data we have suggests that it is less common than, let's say, an allergy to pollen or mites. So to me, the reason I would do a diet trial is if a pet, whether it's a dog or a cat, has non-seasonal disease. So, you know, a diarrhea or soft stools that's been ongoing for, you know, year round. And sometimes they have skin disease with it, too. Or sometimes we just see skin disease only. But if it's non-seasonal, that's when I would pursue a diet trial. Now, having said that, you know, like you say, we don't really know what all of the story is. And maybe this kitty is not exposed to GI parasites.
So you mentioned a diet trial, but we need to know what that means. What is that?
Right. So what we try to do when we are trying, so the problem we have with food allergy, we don't have a diagnostic test. So we rely on clinical clues and what the pet has eaten before. And then when we do a diet trial, our evidence suggests that we can make a diagnosis of food allergy by having a pet on a totally different diet for 8 to 9 weeks. So that's for skin. With GI, usually they get better, you know, they get better more quickly than that. So the diet trial is the start. We're just trying to get the gut or the skin or both to calm down. But the real diagnosis is in feeding the old diet back. And we do that by mixing small amounts in with what I would call the test diet. Now, you know, people always want to know, could I just change brands or could I just change proteins that I'm feeding my dog or cat? And the reality is, we don't have a way to predict what they're allergic to. So modern research suggests that, you know, if an animal is allergic to chicken, they could be allergic to turkey, too. And some animals, I'm thinking of a few French bulldogs I know, they can't eat any animal protein. They have to eat a vegetable-based diet. So the diet we pick really depends on the pet and their history of what they've eaten before.
Either a vegetable-based diet, by the way, we would not do that, I assume, for cats, or a hydrolyzed diet, and you can explain what that is.
Right. So the idea behind hydrolyzing a food, whether it's, you know, a vegetable or a or an animal protein, is you're trying to chop that protein up into small pieces that are less likely to activate that allergic response. So we've had good diets for a long time. And the hydrolyzed diets that are even soy-based are, you know, approved for use in cats because the folks who make them make sure that they're complete and balanced. So they add extra amino acids if they need to. So I think we all know that cats prefer to be carnivores. But for a diagnostic diet, this is not the forever diet. This is just the actual test. So we have a lot of options, and I like hydrolyzed diets.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk more about that. I want to talk more about the difference between a true food allergy and a sensitivity. And in fact, what we haven't touched on, and that is in fact the most common explanation for itchy dogs. And we'll talk, it's not food, but we'll talk about what it is when we come back with Dr. Valerie Fadok on WGN. Dr. Valerie Fadok is a superstar veterinary dermatologist. She's boarded in dermatology. She has been doing this for, well, 4 decades, I believe, plus.
Yeah,
which is incredible. She is also on the board of directors of the Human-Animal Bond Association. She has received numerous awards, including the American College of Veterinary Dermatology Award for Excellence and the Frank Kral Award for recognizing her, you, for outstanding contributions to veterinary dermatology. So we're not talking about a lame dermatologist here, whatever that would mean. We're talking
I was before I had my knee surgery.
But I'm bum. I like it. All right.
Yeah.
So let's go back to what we were talking about, and that is food allergies in dogs. And we were kind of a little bit getting into the weeds about food diet trials and all the rest, not only dogs, but also cats as well. But we should really back it up a step, I think, because it turns out the most common explanation in dogs anyway for itchiness isn't food at all, I don't believe.
Totally true. You know, for years we have known that ectoparasites, and by that I mean, you know, little parasites who live on the skin, not inside the body. And the most common one we have is the flea. So fleas really create a lot of issues for pets. And fortunately, in this day and age, we have wonderful preventives. But, you know, there's some other ectoparasites, too, like especially when I think about cats and over-grooming. There's a little mite that can live in their skin called Demodex gadoi. And it's a weird little mite because it's not down in the hair follicle like we think of with dogs. It lives on the surface of the skin. And it can be hard to find. So we have ways to rule it out. And I always recommend that for over-grooming cats because is a worldwide parasite. And, you know, if you live in a place like I do, Colorado, we don't have the cat flea here. But we have, you know, mites, we have lice. And so, you know, when I hear of a pet itching, whether it's a dog or a cat, the first thing I want to do is make sure we don't have parasites because they're easy to control.
And they're easy to diagnose if you look for them. And
yes,
rather than jumping to assumptions, which brings me to this topic, and that would be artificial intelligence or Dr. Google. So people sometimes go there and get an answer. Have you experienced this? And it's not necessarily the right answer. And I think this happens most with behavioral issues for dogs and cats, but also for dermatology issues.
Yes. Absolutely true. And, you know, I'm not here to knock AI. I use it as a tool. But at least if you use ChatGPT, it can make mistakes. And they have a disclaimer right on the bottom of the page that tells you that. And recently I learned that also AI tools like this can have what they call a hallucinations. And it is where they just kind of it loses its little mind and it makes stuff up. So
I didn't know that. So,
it's really interesting.
So ChatGPT can have hallucinations?
Yes, really any AI tool because, you know, they're learning, right? And if they make a mistake, for me, I'm not offended if a client brings me in a ChatGPT and we talk about it. I think it's admirable that people are trying to get educated, but you shouldn't take the word of an AI tool over your veterinarian.
Or over allowing your veterinarian to see your pet and actually do some testing. So
yes, that is the beginning.
I think the most common complaint is that itchy dog. And it's not only skin itchiness, it's ear gunk, as I use a technical term. So is it as common as I suggest? And then what do people do as step one when their dog or cat, but oftentimes it's a dog, is at 3 a.m. scratching and scratching at those ears?
So what I would recommend, and this is what I do for my own dogs, and I'll just give you an example. One of my Westies started scratching his ears yesterday. So the first thing I did is I put some ear cleaner in his ear because often if you can get on top of the infection early, you may not need to have, you know, a medication with an antibiotic or an antifungal. So I recommend having a good quality ear flush. And if you have a dog with allergies and they get ear infections more than 3 times a year, there is maintenance care we can do. And that sometimes consists of using these ear cleaners as well as a topical steroid in the ear. Topical steroids are very safe. They're easy to get. Cordastrin is one. I recommend a lot of times using Zymox Plus Advanced because it has an enzyme-based a system, so you could put that in the ear. You don't have to clean it, and it has hydrocortisone. Very safe.
Now, all of these things, so Zymox, I believe you could just go to Amazon and get
it. Yes.
You know, so Zymox with a X. Do I remember that right?
Yes, it's called Zymex Plus Advanced because there's, you know, 4 or 5 different products. But if you get the one that's called Advanced, it has the hydrocortisone in it. And hydrocortisone is very safe. That's why it's sold over the counter.
All right. So you use that. But what if So you're saying, first of all, let's back up. You're saying that getting on top, like many issues, finding out what's wrong early and taking making a difference for your dog, taking action is what I want to say. That in of itself can help. But what if that isn't helping and the dog is still shaking its head? And what are the signs of? I mentioned two, scratching and shaking. Are there any others?
Scratching, shaking. Sometimes dogs will run up and down the carpet and, you know, kind of massage their ears into the carpet. Mm. Now, infection in the ear is almost always associated with an odor. So, you know, if your dog's scratching his ear and you lift up that ear flap and you can smell something, that is probably the time to go in to see the veterinarian. And the veterinarian will want to do what we call a cytology. And that is where we put a swab in the ear and we look at it under the microscope to see what kind of bacteria or yeast are present. And that helps us pick the right medication.
And that's
where...
We don't want
this to get chronic.
Okay. And that's where I want to stop you, because there have been huge advances just in the past couple of years regarding treatment for what we're talking about. I want to talk about some of those advances. You've been a part of those stories. Dr. Valerie Fadok is here on WGN. We'll be right back. A legend in veterinary dermatology, Dr. Valerie Fadok is here. And you are a veterinary dermatologist and also have a special interest in the human-animal bond and the impact of the bond, that connection we have with our pets, with all sorts of conditions having to do with dermatology. We'll talk about that. But we were speaking about those itchy ears, and there can be several explanations. You mentioned a couple of the most common ones. Now, at some point, maybe when you began doing what you do, it had to be maybe more frustrating because people weren't as proactive about their pets. And you had limitations, I believe, Dr. Fadok, in what you can do. Today, are things different and incredibly different, even within the past couple of years?
So much better now. You know, it isn't even just people being proactive. Dogs often do not like to have their ears touched. And so some, you know, we in all good faith, when we see your dog or your cat, we are going to make a recommendation for a topical. But what if you can't put a topical? What if your dog runs away or tries to snap at you? And what if your kitty just hides under the bed? The great thing now is we have long-acting medications. So we put them in the ear in the clinic, and you don't have to worry about doing the treatment. You just come back for your recheck so that we can make sure it worked. So we're so lucky now because we have different options, and the long-acting medications have really helped us do a better job with ears.
And the technology is very different, I believe, than it was, 10 years ago even.
Absolutely true. There's a system I really like to use, and we can get the, you know, if there are unusual infections that our commercial products won't control, we can get things compounded in what they call a thermosensitive gel.
What?
And these are really cool.
What is that?
It's so cool. So these are medications that are liquid in the refrigerator, but when you put them in the ear, they make like a soft bandage that holds the medication to the ear for a whole week. And that way, as a pet owner, we don't have to touch their ears. The veterinarian can put these gels in the ears, and it just makes life so much better. They're quite effective.
That and some of the products out there now are antibiotics, but some of them are not at all. Am I right?
Correct. We are developing new ways to treat ear infections that involve either biologic compounds, and some of these, I think, are in use in Europe. We don't have them here yet. And by a biologic, I mean not an antibiotic, but, you know, a compound that's derived from there are certain viruses that can infect bacteria, and they make things that kill the bacteria. So we can actually use those in ears. And I hope to see something in the United States in the next few years. But we also use antiseptics. So we have ways to treat the ears that do not involve using antibiotics. And the value of that is that some of these bacteria can become tremendously resistant. And then it becomes really difficult to treat those ears. It's hard. And my whole goal with ears is I don't want a dog to end up with what we call an end-stage ear. And that is where we actually have to do a surgery called a total ear canal ablation because there's just nothing we can do medically. And it's a wonderful surgery. A good surgeon can really relieve a lot of the pain. But it's a big surgery. So if we can prevent that early in life, then we're all going to be happy.
Does that begin with maintenance? You know, particularly, I suspect, for certain breeds more than others?
Absolutely. You know, I think if I ever had was in general practice again and I was vaccinating puppies, I would talk to people who got cockers or other spaniels about regular ear care. Because it's not that difficult to do, and we might only have to use an ear cleaner in the ear, once a week or sometimes even twice a month. And that way we prevent the bacteria or yeast from building up. So I think if we could start young. And then, too, you know, Frenchies are the most popular breed in the country right now, and they're allergy prone. So maybe we would teach them to accept ear care. And there are ways to do it to make it less, you know, when we get these, we call them ear flushes, but sometimes if you take that bottle and you flush that liquid into the ear, they don't like it. So what I like to do is you put a cotton ball in the ear and you just put the material on the cotton ball and then gently squeeze it into the ear so they don't get that feeling of water flushing into their ears. So there's ways to do this. And you as a behaviorist, you know that we can use our positive reinforcement to help these dogs accept the treatments they need.
Yeah, and if you start young, I would suggest if you're lucky enough to be able to do that, not that that's necessary, but it's helpful. But it's really not necessarily, and associate that ear event, whichever way you choose to do it or your veterinarian and you agree is best for your individual pet, and associate that with the most amazing treat in the world, you can actually get consent from the pet to do it. So you offer a bit of whatever that treat is. You take out whatever product you're using. You don't even put it in the ear yet. And the dog or cat, cats too, have just a little bit of it. You begin to use it. And when the dog or cat says no, you take the treat away. So the cat or dog ultimately will consent to you doing this. And it's sort of the pet's option in a way. Am I explaining this? You know as much about this as I do. Am I doing an okay job?
No, you actually know more about this, but I am so excited that we are moving toward not just, you know, manually restraining dogs, but that we're actually asking them to say it's okay to us. Same thing with cats. You know, my roommate in vet school, she was the cat whisperer, and it was all because she didn't do the things that cats don't like. She was able to do venipunctures and all kinds of treatments because of the respect she had for the cat. And then the cat said, okay, this lady's not so bad.
Well, I have great respect for Dr. Valerie Faduk, as does everyone in the veterinary profession. We'll be right back talking about kind of along the lines of where we're going, and that is the human-animal bond. And we'll talk about that when we come back on WGN. She is a board member of the Human-Animal Bond Association, a veterinary dermatologist, Dr. Valerie Fedak, who, if you are a dermatologist, you know this lady's name. Although most of you listening are probably not veterinary dermatologists, but she is that impactful, and you have been that impactful on the profession. But you've said, wait, it really matters, the connection that people have with their pets. And that connection can fracture when there is a medical problem that has not been rectified. I mean, one example I can give you, years ago, I want to make a point of saying this would not happen today, but it was at Chicago Animal Care and Control where a dog landed who had been in a home for years, 5 years, 4 years, something like that, and lived with the family, a golden retriever, and the kind of golden retriever that you look up goldens in the encyclopedia, and this was your typical friendly, happy, I love everybody golden retriever. Until one day, the boy in the home who was 5, maybe 6 years old went to pet the dog, and the dog turned and bit the boy. And they were actually going to euthanize this dog at that time. And they called me as the behavior guy. And I said, no.
Yeah.
I don't even want to talk about behavior. I want to talk about a medical exam. And at that time, years ago, different today, there was no veterinarian on staff that could do it. So they took the dog to a veterinarian. They found, guess what? You know what's coming, an ear infection.
Yeah.
They treated the infection. That dog was returned to the family and lived to the ripe old age of 11, 12, 13. And there was no other incident or anything close to that. It was like Lassie and Timmy for the rest of their lives, you know?
I love that.
But it might not have happened that way. So talk about the human-animal bond and in itchy dog, two things that you might not think go together, but I know you know that they do.
So, you know, I can share with you that every single atopic dog that I've lived with, and I've lived with, 8 or 9 by now, has been surrendered for their skin. And there's a couple of reasons for this. I think one of them is people get the idea that a certain breed is a great idea. And it just as an example, the French bulldog, they're adorable. They can have a number of medical problems, and skin is one. So sometimes these pets get overbred. They get placed in a home. People do not appreciate how allergies and ear infections are really management. We don't cure these dogs. So we're talking about lifelong treatment. So then these animals get put into shelters or rescue groups, and hopefully the rescues and shelters can find homes. So that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem, I think, is again, the long-term aspect of this. And it does fracture the bond. And I want to share one story with you. It's about a 15-year-old Shih Tzu, cutest little girl on the planet. She belonged to a dentist. And this dog developed really bad ears with a bacteria that we're not used to seeing, but it smells really bad. So as a result of this, the children didn't want to touch the dog anymore. She was no longer allowed to sleep in the bedrooms. The only person who could handle this or who wanted to handle this sweet little dog was the owner, the dentist. So she brought her to me, and we did, you know what, everything we could. We did ear cleaning, and we developed a strategy so that she didn't smell bad anymore. And that little Shih Tzu lived another 3 years. It was easy to manage her, and the bond was restored between the kids and the dog. And that made me feel good. You know, these are the kind of things that I figure, you know, we all can have an impact on understanding why these things occur so that these beloved dogs and cats can stay in their homes.
And it's not only a matter of that. It's also, for example, way early on in our conversation, I mentioned the itchy dog at 3 in the morning. could be cat too. And now that dog or cat may not be sleeping in the bedroom anymore. So it doesn't mean the people necessarily are going to relinquish that animal. But the human-animal bond between that animal and that family has changed when, in most cases, I don't believe it needs to.
I totally agree. And, you know, one of my missions is I like to give people strategies to use at home for that situation so that the dogs don't get banned from the bedroom. I like to give people strategies to take care of these acute itching problems. We have medications we can do. You know, if it's during the day, I often recommend a tepid bath because nothing cools the skin like tepid water. 3 a.m, that's probably not going to work. But we have rapidly acting medications that can stop that. And then the goal is to prevent that from happening again. So that's where we partner with our pet owners who love their dogs and their cats. Can we find a way to minimize the impact of this chronic disease? It's kind of like when we go to the I have asthma, so I use that as an example. You know, I work with my physicians to find a way so that I don't wheeze and wake up in the night. And it's working. And we can do that for our pets, too.
I know you're on the board of the Human-Animal Bond Association, humananimalbond.net, to learn more or to join this organization. We only have about a minute or so left. Why is this so important to you? And I know it is.
It's important to me because I think we have a mutually beneficial relationship with the animals we live with. And I think it helps keep us connected to nature. So we get so many benefits from our pets, and I think they get benefits from us. They're very loving relationships, so I like to promote it.
Well, indeed you do, Dr. Valerie Fadok. First off, thank you for everything you have done and continue to do for veterinary medicine. HumanAnimalBond.net to learn more about the Human-Animal Bond Association and the Air Academy, which offers to any of you like cutting-edge science and information from real experts. Dr. Fadok, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
It's always fun talking to you. Thank you. For years, FIP, or feline infectious peritonitis, was considered a death sentence. Today, no more. It is treatable, very treatable, and we've talked about that on the radio. You can hear an interview that I did with Dr. Brian Holub about all this at WGNradio.com. Look for Steve Dale's Pet World, and then look for that interview. Drugs like GS441524, that's the name of the drug, remdesivir, a drug used for people, and related medications, for most cats diagnosed, they are likely to recover. But veterinary professionals want to increase the odds even more. Is there a way to do that? Well, maybe, it turns out. Writing in Clinician's Brief, Dr. Matthew Cornea of the University of Guelph and Every Cat Health Foundation highlighted a newly published study in the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine that offers an important FIP clue never previously known. Researchers found that a common blood marker called LDH was the strongest predictor of short-term survival in cats receiving antiviral treatment for FIP. So the study followed, follow me now, this isn't that technical, 108 cats treated with remdesivir, that GS441524, or a combination of both. 13 cats, about 12%, did not survive. Most of those deaths occurred during the first week. And again, this reinforces the importance of early treatment for FIP. And that means early diagnosis of FIP. The encouraging news is that the overwhelming majority of cats completed the standard 84-day treatment course. Even two cats that relapsed, well, they did fine when they were treated again. And those cats overall, they're doing great. By the way, as a side note, I said 84-day treatment. Yes, for the study, but what we're learning is that treatment course of 84 days may soon be cut in half. which is a cost savings, among other things, for cat owners. Now, anyway, getting back to the study, it turns out that researchers, when analyzing all the data together, there was only one factor, elevated LDH, that remains statistically significant as a predictor for survival. So, or non-survival if they have elevated LDH. Elevated LDH means they are less likely, those kittens, to survive, which is something we didn't know. Now, is that a reason to give up hope for these kittens, by the way? No. Still, they should be treated, and still, they may well survive. Well, I'm about to play Let's Get Legal. We've all heard about antiquated laws, I mean, laws on the books that you just can't believe are still there. Well, let me give you some examples. In Provo, Utah, it's been illegal for dogs and cats to live in the same home. It's true. Apparently, the wise politicians in that town really believed that they will, well, fight like cats and dogs. So, since the early 1900s, cats and dogs have been segregated. The problem was discovered when a lady by the name of Susan Sewell, a local resident, wanted to adopt a kitten. But because she had a dog, she was refused. She protested, and yes, the city ordinance was changed. In Colonia, Italy, an even stranger law. In that town of 37 people, it's actually illegal to talk to your animals. Well, that's unless they talk to you first. Then it's legal, and I suppose actually polite. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.